Deep in the farthest recesses of the most distant jungle lies a city. A city populated by the most mysterious, terrifying, and downright grotesque denizens ever seen by mortal eye. Here, in the darkened corners of this cavernous locale, sits an ordinary, average brick building with an innocuous, ordinary, average blinking neon sign which reads, On Air. It is here where each week, Seth Breedlove and Mark Matzke convene to discuss the greatest mysteries the world has ever known. Now, strap on your hiking boots, grab your trusty walking stick, and don't forget your machete as we begin our journey through Monsteropolis.
This is Monsteropolis, a show about anomalies, legends, and monsters. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Seth Breedlove. I'm joined by my pal.
That was a big, deep breath.
Look.
Like,
Mark Matzke. Like it's here's the thing. Like, it's way earlier than it normally is when we record, just to let a little peek behind the curtain. I'm going to be leaning like this the whole day, too, now. For those that tune in and every week and don't know how we record this is how it's going to be. It's 9 a.m. on a Wednesday morning. And we will sit here for the next, probably 3 hours, maybe even longer, right? Three hours.
And then, regaling you with tales.
Yeah, and this is so we actually, the way we do this is we sit down and we record the entire month worth of shows in one setting. So sometimes Mark's fallen asleep by the last show. Sometimes I am asleep during the last show and Mark just talks.
But that's what was going on with the Lyle Blackburn show, as I was asleep.
Mark
was
actually just sound asleep, but never have any doubts that he's here. Yeah. He's always with us. Always with me.
Using the Zach Palmisano pillow.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a pillow with my friend Zach's face on it in the studio. So anyway, that's how we record the show. So if you ever want to know, you know, like how we know so far in advance what topics are, it's because we record everything in one go. And it's actually, we did this with Sasswood, didn't we? Occasionally.
Yeah, we would double up and triple up on topics.
And very early on, I was recording multiple episodes in a week. I mean, we went from zero to 20 in 2 months. It was a very quick period of time, and then of a period of time growth things. I need coffee. So anyway, this week we're gonna talk about. Okay, so this is the other thing. Is the way this seems to be simplifying things for us is if we come up with some sort of guiding topic or theme for each set of episodes that we're recording. So this next 4 episodes will all be themed around things that we love. So this week's episode is gonna be about the Chestnut Ridge. And I'll give you a guess who picked that topic. it's not me. But we're gonna go through that today. But first, I think we should get. So we have teased multiple times that we have a podcast email, an email specifically for Monsteropolis, where people can send us emails and we'll read them on air and interact. And then we've never actually done it. So we checked the email today. We remembered to check monsteropolismail@gmail.com today. And we had a whopping 2 emails sent in by listeners. So we're going to read those. Mark's going to read those. And then we will respond, unless they're just emails telling us that we didn't put enough effort into the Injured Cold episode.
Okay. This was sent in on December 22nd. It says, hey guys, I'm so excited y'all are podcasting again. I'm also happy y'all have more flexibility with Monsteropolis to talk about behind the scenes STM and other creatures. Keep up the great work. Mark, I almost called you today. I stopped for gas in Fauk, and someone was dressed in a combo Bigfoot and Santa costume at Monster Mart. My wife tried to get me to go take a picture, but I was ready to get to our destination, maybe tomorrow when we head back home. Take care, and Merry Christmas, your buddy Bevel from Arkansas.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's cool.
Yeah, I miss the Monster Mart, and I miss Fauk right now. We were actually supposed to be down there last month, and it just never we couldn't get the wheels turning on what we were trying to get together. But I missed that place probably more than almost any place we've filmed. I don't miss Elkhorn. Sorry, Elkhorn folks. Elkhorn listeners. The only thing I miss about Elkhorn is Someplace Else, which was the restaurant we ate at twice, right?
We talk about that pretty much anytime Elkhorn comes up.
Their cheese curds.
It defaults to Someplace Else.
Yeah, I did love Alton, but I think we're actually going to get to go back to Alton because it's only like 40 minutes from Louisiana, Missouri, where we're going to be shooting Momo. So my plan is to actually try to go there because Brandon might be with us when we film in Louisiana. I'd like to at least take him to see Alton, even though the movie will be like right on the verge of coming out when we film.
And Monster Mart continues to like upgrade their facilities there, don't they? Like they keep adding more Bigfoot paraphernalia.
Yeah, I think they actually have like the museum part has expanded from what I saw. And last time I was there, it had changed drastically from when we filmed.
Okay.
Like even when I was there for the premiere, which would have been my last time down. And that was only, 7 months later, 8 months later, something like that. Thanks for the email, Bevel. And keep monster hunting in Fauk.
Yeah.
I got to come up with like a line to say to people. Keep keeping on.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Next letter was sent on Tuesday, January 29th. It says, "Hi, guys. Just wanted to drop a note with some virtual applause for your Monsteropolis podcast. I'm catching up on past episodes, and I'm enjoying all the topics you've been covering. I grew up in Summit County, Ohio, and southeastern West Virginia in the 1960s. Mysterious creatures and creepy lore were a big part of my culture, including odd stories passed down by older generations. I hope you do that special podcast you mentioned all about West Virginia. My dad was a staunch believer in Bigfoot and UFOs. I was more intrigued with Mothman and Thunderbirds. All in all, real or not, considering such things makes for a rich and fun world. I listen to your show on Podbean, and if there is a place I can leave you a review other than iTunes, please tell me about it. Not joining the Apple cult ever, LOL," and that's from Wynn.
I don't blame you. I wouldn't want to join the Apple cult either, even though pretty much everything I work on these days is Apple. We need to do an entire month, I think, of West Virginia lore. I think that maybe next month we might
to hear some of Wynn's handed down stories.
Yeah, that's the thing is if any of our listeners come from the state of West Virginia, please send in your own sort of tales that were told to you. I mean, that was the whole drive behind the Flatwoods Monster movie. It was how in West Virginia, that is very much part of the culture there is oral tradition and the stories that people tell and how those stories morph over time. And that is a big part of the growing up there. Like Ashley that we interviewed in the Flatwoods Monster has so many stories that we didn't get to in the film that I'd love to touch on sometime. Let me think here.
So we could have Mountaineer Month. It would be the all West Virginia all the time.
That's just my life. I wear a shirt that says that. All right, let's get into the topic because we're 9 minutes into the show.
Okay.
I've suitably killed enough time where I won't have to show how little I've done my research for this episode. Let's get in.
All right. Well, you know, we're around, like you said, for February, our theme is sort of stuff we love. And for me, Chestnut Ridge is one of those topics that I continue to return to again and again. And so this isn't going to be so much like the main stories so much as it is, I think, more obscure Chestnut Ridge stories that are out there in amongst the files of people like Stan Gordon and Paul Johnson and stuff. Because mm-hmm. we've covered the big ones. I mean, yeah. like the.
I'm smiling at you because I didn't do any research. So I'm probably going to just jump back to telling people about Uniontown. And.
Well, that's good. I mean, the one thing I did want to talk about a little bit more is Sam Sherry's up close and personal encounter. Because the details of that he told
Toothless.
Paul Johnson are yeah. really, yeah.
Yeah.
Very, very weird one of and
my
gross.
It's actually one of my favorite Bigfoot encounter stories because it's so strange. For listeners who don't know about the Chestnut Ridge, can you set it up for us as the narrator of the film Invasion on Chestnut Ridge by Small Town Monsters, directed by Seth Breedlove, written by Mark Maskey?
Yes. In fact, the Chestnut Ridge is situated southeast of
you started
Pittsburgh.
Slipping into the narration.
And it runs from approximately, well, how long is it? I forget. How many miles?
72
miles.
If I'm not mistaken. Yeah. 72.
And it runs roughly in a southwesterly to northeasterly direction up to Indiana County, Pennsylvania, and down into... even, you know, it runs
above Morgantown.
Right. And it's West not Virginia. That big a ridge per se. I mean, traveling across it, you can drive the ridge, you know, drive up and down in probably a half hour or less.
We've done it.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't stay on the ridge, but we stayed very close to the ridge.
Yeah. So
there's actually multiple ridges where we were anyway,
mm-hmm.
which was south, more southerly, southerly.
Southerly.
Going back to bed.
Yeah. Yeah, and a lot of the locations of sightings have taken place in the small communities that sort of dot either side of the ridge. Some of the place names that you hear a lot of are places like Derry, and that's on the southeasterly side of the ridge. And that, like in the Champion area is where we stayed for the filming, down in the Haunted Valley.
Which we were right across the street from like a resort. And at night you could hear people partying and there were fireworks. And we never felt very isolated there.
Not very.
No.
There was an archery exhibition going on, wasn't there, at the Seven Springs?
Well, that lodge was shocking too, because I had no idea that existed, and we went inside and it was like a whole community unto itself. Like they had restaurants and shops and all kinds of stuff in there, and it's right down the street from us, and we're trying to film a movie about like haunted, mysterious, isolated locations around the world.
So I mean, essentially what you have is on the northwestern side of the ridge is urban America and then suburban America and then some rural communities and smaller cities like Greensburg, for example. And then if you were to continue in a southeast direction and cross the ridge, then you get down into the smaller towns and the places like Derry and not Ligonier per se, that's a little bit north. But it's... Have you enjoyed your journey?
For listeners, I just cracked open my personal copy of Silent Invasion, and it says, written by Stan Gordon, it says, Lance, enjoy your journey into the unusual.
Lance. Is that your nom de plume?
I'm pretty sure I bought this used on Amazon.
Okay.
Unless he... Stan still Breedlove. Doesn't know my name.
Yeah, he would always ask me, how's Lance doing? And I just would look at him blankly. But, yeah, so that's the Chestnut Ridge. And the thing that's really very interesting to me, and we got into this in just a little bit in the historical elements of the film, is that the kind of south of the ridge, that was settled largely because of a lot of the natural resources and coal and iron and other things. And when those went away, you actually ended up with communities that basically became ghost towns and so forth. And that's something that Paul Johnson brings up in his book, his most recent book. He goes looking for and finds, in some cases, little communities that no longer exist. And there's that element to the ridge as well of history that's come and gone. And I think that adds a lot to the mystique of the area.
And sort of one of the big aspects, I guess you would call it, of the Chestnut Ridge is the fact that so much of the activity there is so varied. So that's, you know, like it's not just Bigfoot or UFOs. It's kind of, it runs the gamut of what's going on there.
Right. And I think it's those type of cases that I wanted to really touch on today.
Although,
should we touch?
Touch on one.
I will touch on
that's
one.
That's not.
There is, yes. There's,
it's one of those shows.
It is. So, for example, you have the encounter with a Butler County ferry.
Oh.
Yes.
We're going right into
we're,
it.
We're jumping in. And this was in the summer of 2005, a witness account from a man named Jonathan. He says, I had a very unusual sighting, yet it was almost something of a blessing to witness. Mm. Myself and an entire group witnessed a ferry close up. Nobody knew what to say. It started with a phone call from a friend inviting me and my girlfriend at the time out to his parents' house in the country areas of Chicora, Pennsylvania, which has many other odd occurrences and sightings, one of which is a bat squatch, evidently. Yeah. We accompanied a gathering of seven or eight. It was a casual evening, nothing crazy, and no drugs to induce any hallucinations. Porch was more of a deck on which they were sitting, roughly 10 by 15 feet. To the far side of the deck, my friend's mom had a huge pile of pots and plants that rested against the railing, and it was about 10 p.m. Suddenly, during one of those quiet moments in conversation, we heard a pot tink as if it were lightly bumped. Being out in the woods in the dark, all of us turned to see what kind of animal was spying on us. To our surprise, as we all turned to look, mind you, I had a front row seat the whole time, we saw what looked like either an enormous moth or a rather large bat shoot straight up from the pile of pots. However, this thing had wings that were wrapped around its body like a tortilla, and I immediately noticed something that blew my mind, a human head with extremely long ears, almost as if they were to be disguised as antennas. There's no human hair on this creature, so it shot straight up from the pile of pots. What happened next totally threw us all in a spin. It reached its maximum launch height and hung suspended in midair for about half a second when suddenly its wings burst open into a full spread right in front of the porch spotlight. I could not believe what I was seeing. It was a perfect slender human female body with wings attached along the entire side of its body from fingertips to toes and then some. Her body was solid and silhouetted against the light. Her wings resembled the skin of an earlobe, almost like bat's wings. Being in front of the light, I could somewhat see through her wings and actually saw the veins that carried blood throughout her body. Her skin, I assume, was a pale green pigment, and I say assume because her entire body and wings were covered in what looked like tiny white hairs, but there was something magical seeming about her hair because it carried a definite soft green glow around her entire entity. I drew pictures to try to describe how she at first appeared, wrapped up in her wings, and then how she opened up to a full spread X figure. She was a combination of human and butterfly with a biological twist of a bat.
Oh.
And there's a picture of said creature.
Who drew that? Does it, is the actual witness?
Used with permission of the witness, so okay. I assume it's Jonathan.
There was an encounter or an account of giant translucent caterpillars that you had written into the script for Invasion on Chestnut Ridge and then I cut out.
Yes.
What was that encounter? Do you have that on your list?
Well, I don't have it on my list, but it really, over the years, we have conflated that, I think, to make it sound much more interesting than it actually is. Because when you hear giant,
like
I tend to think of like Volkswagen
size.
And what they really meant was about, I guess, 6 inches long.
Well, that's not giant.
I know. They used the term giant, I guess, in relation to other caterpillars.
Darn it.
But it really ends up to be more like a large kielbasa. sized okay. creature.
That's disgusting.
Yeah.
I don't think about that. I would be remiss if we did a show about the Chestnut Ridge where we're talking about our favorite, Chestnut Ridge encounters. If I didn't talk about Barry,
Barry Clark.
Barry Clark. And Barry is in our Invasion on Chestnut Ridge film and told his story about investigating a series of sightings that were taking place on a farm. Where's that farm located? I can't think right now. Westmoreland? Is it Westmoreland?
Yes.
I think it's during the Beast of Westmoreland section of the film. Westmoreland County. He was investigating there and had a strange sighting of a craft or lights in the sky. And then there were ongoing effects that included possible like alien abduction. The creepiest part of the story is that he had a grandson that lived with them, and the grandson started experiencing things as well. And one of the things that he experienced was men coming through a hole in the ceiling, which that description's always creeped me out. It's also just his entire demeanor, the way he told the story, has always stuck with me. We shot that movie 2 years ago, and that's still probably my favorite account that we've taken. It's also the only one, other than maybe like John Frederickson, where I was creeped out during the interview just by what the person was telling us they had experienced. And I've always been kind of creeped out by abduction, like alien abduction stuff to begin with. And his story went to some really dark places that we actually had us turn the camera off and we weren't able to continue recording. So there were some very disturbing physical ramifications on him after that series of sightings. And that story, it's hard to say that's a favorite because we actually spoke to someone that, you know, had it affected their lives, but it's definitely the most memorable of all the stories we've been told. He had missing time after the sighting, you know, like multiple times. Like he'd be driving to a location on a road and wind up, you know, at another location, and like 3-4 hours had passed, and then to him it felt like 15 minutes, and all sorts of strange, what we would, I think, today identify as side effects of like an alien abduction. He experienced many of those things, and it drove him completely out of the research into the paranormal. He burned or threw away his all his files.
He gave them away at the very least. He may have destroyed them.
I thought he said he destroyed them.
Yeah,
but what was interesting is when we interviewed him, he was also talking about getting back into it. I'd be curious if he has. I've seen Stan. We haven't even asked him about it. We need to ask him about it next time we see him.
Yeah, he still seemed stunned.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as I talked to him to prevent him from leaving.
Yeah, oh yeah.
He was animated and very, you know, just like having a normal conversation with anyone, just talking about this and that and how filming was going and so forth. But when he started to relive his experiences, there was a sense that he almost started to separate.
I was going to say it was like an out of body. It almost seemed like he was having an out of body experience or something, because he was not emotive during that interview. He was very deadpan, just sort of staring ahead. And there were a couple times where he doesn't even blink, like he's just sitting there. And that was a very creepy, unsettling interview. The whole thing unfolded on the Chestnut Ridge. If I'm not mistaken, when he actually saw the craft come down, or the lights come down, was that the 80s? Is that, or am I, or was it the 70s?
Somewhere late 70s, okay. Early 80s, yeah.
Okay, so I have to at least mention that story because it's one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm. And I thought what was really intriguing to me is that Zach and Jason were there for that interview. And, they kind of
laugh a lot of this off.
Yeah, they do. But their reaction to that interview was really pretty cool, because I don't think they were ready for that level of someone, unbearing themselves.
Yeah, the
interview
ended, and they went outside. Zach went outside and was just like smoking off by himself and standing. I mean, everyone was really quiet after that interview. That's the only time I can think of where we had that sort of experience after interviewing a witness. I wish some elements of the story had made it into the film, that he had let us record a little bit more, but nonetheless, trust us. It's a very creepy story.
Mm-hmm. Now, a point of connection between his story and the next story that I wanted to share is that, you know, what the terrain around Chestnut Ridge is fairly mountainous, and it's also there's fertile spots and lots of farms, and it seems like a lot of the investigations that took place in the 70s and 80s and even up to more modern investigations, like some of which Johnson writes about in his book, or into the 2000s, that seems to center around farms and farmsteads, either people who have farmed that land for decades and generations, or people who, you know, just buy a farmhouse because they think it'd be a cool thing to do, and they want to have sort of the pastoral landscape that prevails out there. And so there is another farmstead that Johnson reports about in Chasing the Elusive Pennsylvania Bigfoot around the same time, and it really has me intrigued because I don't know if it's the same farm or if it's another one that's adjacent to the same place where Barry Clark had a lot of his experiences. But this takes place from 1978 to 1984 in Bell Township near the town of Apollo in Westmoreland County. Many of the sightings center around a family living in an old farmhouse along Route 819. The main witnesses were Sam Frew, his wife Ruth, and their 12-year-old son. And in 1979, the Frew family and several of their neighbors began hearing eerie growling and hissing sounds. The vocalizations were loud and usually preceded by a cessation of normal night noises like crickets and tree frogs. And incidents happened periodically over the next 2 years, occurring most often between April and November. And Ruth Frew kept a journal of the incidents. Sam mapped the area where they heard the sounds. And by the time the research center that Johnson was running entered the case, there were 34 separate occasions where they heard and marked where these sounds were coming from. There was...
What kind of sounds?
Eerie growling and hissing.
Okay. Hissing.
Yes. Hmm. Yeah. And I mean, that's...
Giant snake. But it's a python, maybe.
Imported through the wormhole. But there was... the family began referring to the culprit as a quote-unquote mystery, like a name. And so... It was April 18th, 1981. Sam Frew had the opportunity to briefly observe mystery around 10 p.m. They were in their living room watching TV when they heard a loud, shrill call outside. Sam grabbed his rifle and flashlight before heading out the door. Sam followed the sound up the hill to the field behind the house. He turned and walked along a path that paralleled the field, and to his right, in the flashlight beam, he saw a figure walking in the woods. It was bipedal, very wide and heavy, but only about 4 feet tall. It was completely covered with hair and had large reddish-orange eyes. While holding the rifle barrel and flashlight in his left hand, Sam shot at the creature, which at this point was about 50 yards away. He didn't know if he hit it or not, but after the shot was fired, he was unable to see the creature anymore. That's a very ambiguous way of describing, did it vanish, did it jump in the woods, or what? But it's that type of detail that Chestnut Ridge is very famous for. Yeah.
That brings me to the Ohio Pile incident with the lady who and again, like, Mark's going with deep dive accounts here, and I'm going with ones that I know because I've looked into them myself.
Yeah.
I do have two recent that I want to talk about, just because I would like to end this by talking about the fact that everything happening on the Chestnut Ridge is ongoing, like, and it seems to get weirder every year. But the Ohio Pile incident was what, 70s, late 70s, early 80s, mm-hmm. something in
yeah.
there. A lady was
76 or 77.
Yeah, it's a
like
lady.
The gas shortage thing is. What.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, there was a gas shortage, and so she was eating some beans up in the cabin, and so she was She's up in this cabin by herself, and there's like a scraping sound or something on her front door or on her front porch, and there had been some wild dogs roaming around the area, so she assumed it was the wild dogs. So she got her gun, a rifle, and opened the door, expecting to see a dog, but instead there's a giant 8-foot-tall hairy creature with its hands over its head. And she opens the door, and she sees it, and she fires at it. And as soon as she does, there's a bright flash of light, and the creature vanishes, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. Okay, so she goes back in the house, and her son-in-law, who lives down the street, her son, who lives right down the street, they hear the gunshot. They call up to see what's going on. She tells him. He starts up the road with his gun, and about halfway there, he starts to notice all these other 8-foot-tall hairy creatures, and they're sort of, if I'm not mistaken, they start surrounding him essentially, mm-hmm. and at that moment, an object appears in the sky. What happens from there? I'm blanking. Does he fire at one of them or something like that?
I forget if he fires or not, but he. Takes off running or yeah, something.
Takes off back up to the house, and they get to the house, and the rest is now for us guys like me to make jokes about farting. I apologize, listeners. This is like 10 o'clock in the morning. So, yeah, that's always been one of my favorites just because I love that Ohio Pile area. And it's a really creepy place, actually, up on those back roads, especially at night. So if you can imagine someone living up off one of those like back dirt roads, you know, like you can definitely picture this unfolding in a very creepy manner. And for listeners who've watched Invasion on Chestnut Ridge, a lot of the footage was actually shot at Ohio Pile. The movie actually begins with Ohio Pile. The shot heading toward the hill, and the hill starts turning upside down. That's the Chestnut Ridge, but it's Ohio Pile. Where we shot that. So I love that area. And there's a little town there with an amazing restaurant that has the best Reuben. Got to go sometime.
Yes. Yeah. We were down there last year for whitewater rafting.
Yeah. So, I think you told me about that.
Yeah. You know, the detail that I really love about that story is how the woman always consistently described what she saw as a gorilla. So... for whatever reason, she wasn't influenced by the sort of the Bigfoot craze of the 70s, or just that isn't what she said she saw. She always used the language of gorilla, and she never said Bigfoot or Sasquatch was standing in the doorway. So, kind of cool.
Yeah. Do you have another one you want to get to?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. This one, again, heightens the weirdness factor quite a bit. And it was in August of 1985, a family of three was taking an evening drive when they encountered something that they could not explain. The parents and child were traveling on a country road near the Loyalhanna Dam. They were approaching a wooded area when the headlights hit something. Mother noticed something strange on the limb of a tree. They passed within a few feet of the location. They all saw something strange. They agreed they should turn around and take another look at what was there. For some reason, they all had a feeling that they wanted to return, but something was keeping them from doing so. Later, they thought that would have been the normal thing to do and couldn't explain their reaction. What was seen was difficult and complex to describe. The mother was able to sketch quite a detailed drawing that helps to explain what was observed. The woman obtained a detailed view of the phenomena, and what she first noticed were two ring-shaped devices made up of a bluish-white light that were about 10 feet above the ground. The light was similar in appearance to a fluorescent tube. The first ring was about 5 feet in diameter and was just suspended in a horizontal position. The second ring, that appeared to be about the same diameter, was hovering above it in a more diagonal position, yet not touching the other one. The rings appeared to be within some type of vertical tubular structure. Within the second ring, the woman saw what looked like a vertical crooked stick. Her son believed this was actually a brown snake. There appeared to be turbulence within the tube-like device, since they could see leaves or debris, such as twigs, sticks, and small pebbles, swirling around. It was then that they noticed the tree limb about 15 to 20 feet above the ground that hung out partially over the roadway. Around the limb was what could only be described as a massive round, transparent energy form that sparkled. There was something else within it, like arms, but it wasn't clear until weeks later when memories of what was seen that night began to resurface. The woman recalled seeing the creature on the tree limb that night, but that it was transparent. There was a brownish spark like glitter around the body as though it was a part of it. The being was stretched out on the limb and was estimated to be about 10 feet tall if it were standing. The body appeared to be extremely thin, but had a graceful appearance to it. The outline of the creature was solid, yet you could see through the body. The woman felt that as their car was approaching the area, the creature was looking in their direction. In describing it, the witness said it looked anthropomorphic, somewhat human-like. The head seemed much larger than that of a human. The face appeared to be similar to an upside-down pear shape with only a slit for the mouth. And here's a picture of what it is.
Kind of like Dover Demon almost.
Yeah, it's Dover Demon-ish if the Dover Demon were 10 feet tall instead of 2 or 3 feet tall.
That's creepy.
Laying out on this limb over above this weird tube-shaped object.
A whirling dervish.
A whirling dervish, indeed. For the 20th century.
Every single thing I'm saying is making me laugh. Like a 12-year-old. I like that.
Yeah.
I'd never heard that one.
Yeah.
Okay. As alluded to, the sightings along the ridge are an ongoing thing, and every single time we talk to Stan Gordon, he's got some new story. I had breakfast with him at CryptidCon back in 2017, and he told me a story about this thing. It reminded me of the Grafton Monster. It was like it was headless, but there were eyes in its chest, and it was seen by a police officer somewhere up by a power line out. And this was real recent, like within the last 2 years. So that was a really strange story. But I found two just standard UFO reports I wanted to mention real quickly. One of them I do not have permission to recount. Like I didn't ask for permission. And the witness is a listener of the show. So if he isn't happy with it, he'll let me know. But I don't think he's going to care because I'm going to talk about it very vaguely. He had a sighting of like a translucent UFO shape moving across the sky that intersected with a contrail and a jet. And his sighting lasted for a little while, and he was able to see like that translucent. What is it with translucent? That seems to come up a lot on the ridge.
It does. Yeah, it's very weird. A lot of this, you know, energy related descriptions and sightings along power line areas and so forth.
And then he said it did seem to just fade out eventually. Definitely not an aircraft is what he told me. So then that was recent. These are both real recent. This other one is extremely recent, and this was printed on Stan Gordon's website, so I'm just reading it right off there. But the report was received on the 24th of January, 2019, near Hopwood, PA. The time of sighting was 9:30 a.m., which is when we started recording the show. And this was real recent. If you're listening in the last, that would have been the 24th. So that was just a few weeks ago. I was clearing the snow from my front steps and noticed what looked to be a black ball hovering in the sky. It was over the trees in front of the house and just seemed to be floating there. What was strange was that it was growing larger, but not moving closer. It just sat there in the sky for about 2 minutes. So this was a 2 minute long sighting. I tried to take a picture with my phone, but as soon as I got the phone out, snow had hit the camera lens and the picture blurred out. The ball then slowly began moving away and also was shrinking in size. It hadn't gone very far. Then it just shrank out of sight. That was the last I saw of it. I watched it for no more than 5 minutes. So that's a more recent one. All this is to say that the activity on the ridge is not really, it's hard to catalog what everything that happens there, like things merge together, and there's a lot of Thunderbird reports and Dogman accounts and orbs in the sky and orbs in the woods and portals in the woods and all kind of weird stuff. So we'll have to do, maybe we'll do the West Virginia month and then we'll come back and we'll hit Chestnut Ridge and do like a Chestnut Ridge month at some point. Like each show focuses on one of the different, you know, phenomena that are seen there.
Right. And that's what's so fascinating, I think, about the ridge is that the stuff is constantly shifting. It seems like it's always a couple moves ahead of where the popular consciousness is. I mean, it's sort of, it's known for Bigfoot and UFOs, but it seems like what people are seeing in the moment now is so far ahead in very weird ways, like the tube stuff and the black orbs, and just it's way out in front of people.
We need to do, at some point, we had actually talked about doing like an entire miniseries on the ridge, so we might come back to that on the trail of the Chestnut Ridge. All right, so thanks for listening. Make sure you send emails to monsteropolismail@gmail.com. Visit us on Facebook, Twitter, not Instagram, apparently. The Kickstarter is still live when you're listening to this, so if you're a Small Town Monsters fan and you want to get in, you can back. Unfortunately, by the time you listen to this, the On the Trail of Bigfoot credits will be closed, so you won't be able to get your name in the credits of On the Trail of Bigfoot, but the entire campaign is still open, and you can still get your name in the credits of both movies. I just have to ship off On the Trail of Bigfoot to the printer, so we're closing that up.
There will be insane stretch goals at this point when this runs. I mean, you'll be...
Yeah, by now we've added... so the first stretch goal is going to be a three-hour-long commentary track that I was hoping you might join me for. That's like one of the stretch goals. The other stretch goal is going to be the Momo t-shirts are going to have crew, the Small Town Monsters logo and crew member printed on the back, which we also did with Boggy Creek Monster, and people really seem to like. And then we've got a really cool, well, by the time you listen to this, it'll probably be a thing. So we're, the other stretch goal is going to be like a special Terror in the Skies alternate slipcase. So people loved the alternate art for the Flatwoods Monster last year, but they were upset that they didn't get Sam's art too. So this year we're just going to have this slipcase that goes over the DVD, so you still get Sam's art. You'll actually get two versions of Sam's art, because we also have one of the teaser posters he did, and then one of Adrian's alternate posters for the movie, signed by the crew. And those are all the stretch goals. We have something else planned past that next stretch goal if we were to somehow magically hit it. So we'll have to see what happens. But if you're a fan of STM, back. If not, no big deal. Our stuff's free on multiple platforms. You can go watch it for free.
Mm-hmm.
All right. That does it. That does it for the show.
Monsteropolis is proudly presented on Wadsworth Community Radio 97.1 FM or streaming live at wadsworthcommunityradio.com. It is proudly underwritten by Thurber's Jewelers on the Square in downtown Wadsworth.